Identity at the Mountain. The Mountain was a retreat center in North Carolina, popular with our Atlanta groups. Run by the Unitarians at that time, it was just north of the Georgia border and up above everything. The Vedanta Society was fortunate in the spring of 1983 to secure a reservation for our weekend retreat. Earlier retreats were held in Mountain City, Georgia, in a very rustic locale. At the Mountain, we had better facilities. From that peak, one seems to look down upon the whole world, as if from great metaphysical heights. But our experience of it was not what it should have been because of rain through almost the whole weekend. However, we had study to do, and the sessions were long and intense. What follows is the substance of the presentations. Identity crisis. We can become identified with things in surprising ways. When ice cream parlors of a certain brand disappeared from the city where I live, an acquaintance told me she felt devastated. When I heard the news, I was depressed for weeks, she said. Discarding the false identities is a fairly comprehensible and widely used self-help procedure. But let us be more subtle. Discarding is also relating, that is, it involves our sense of identity, our personal limits, our integrity. Vedanta makes a two-pronged assault on the problem of identity, a short-range one involving our present life and who we are in time, space, and circumstances, and a long-range one aiming at our absolute, unconditioned identity, or who we really are. We need to go about these two searches concurrently, for they are closely related, and the more our spiritual outlook matures, the closer they are seen to be. Thus we are shooting for the stars and keeping our feet on the ground. The so-called identity crisis dates at least from the time when doubt was thrown, in the Age of Enlightenment, upon the Christian doctrine of a God-created soul. Although Martin Luther did not directly attack this, nor even disbelieve it, in many ways his is the watershed figure in the vast shift which took place in the minds of the populace. The phrase identity crisis, however, is modern, post-World War II. From the turn of the century till then, we were looking to our cultural leaders to tell us who we were. For example, Wordsworth and other poets substituted for the soul a romantic self. Matthew Arnold moaned that the self is being lost, whereas T.S. Eliot deplored a divided self. D.H. Lawrence gives us a new self, born of the secular religion of love, while Yeats, who, we may interpolate, had a fair understanding of Vedantic ideas, prefers the secular religion of art. Coming down the years, we hear from Beckett of a zero self. More recently, someone has said, "You are a person through other persons." It's quite a span of ideas. Flexibility and identity. Erik Erikson, one of the most prominent spokesmen on psychology of our day, espoused an identity diffusion. There was no integrated self-concept, and no integral and stable idea of others in relation to oneself. How very opposite to a system of relations totally defined and fixed, as in the way of Confucius. The illness of our society is evidenced by, among other things, the divorce rate. People now speak of temporary commitment, and the feeling of having no purpose, both individually and collectively. National and international events have become a form of theater, which can be followed on the news media like soap opera. From the radio comes this bit of weighty fluff, Kermit the Frog to Peter Sellers. Quote, "Just relax and be yourself." Sellers, "Impossible. I could never be myself." Kermit, "Never yourself?" Sellers, "No, you see, there is no me. I don't exist." Kermit, "I beg your pardon?" Sellers, "There used to be a me, but I had it surgically removed." The manipulation of others has come to be not merely approved, but admired and emulated. There are recent excellent examples in the TV shows JR and Dallas, and in the sordid history of Richard Nixon. One has to ask, is flexibility the supreme value in all the phases of our life? If so, then what is the meaning of vows, as in marriage or monastic life? Many of today's commitments are minimal, and continuity falls ever lower in the scale of values. Many American families used to know the genealogy of their fathers, forefathers, and mothers. Now rootlessness is rife in American life. How many options we have in this rich land? One has only to visit in the third world to see that our amplitude of choice on every side, in every field, even leaves us bewildered. There is much talk of community, but where is it? What is it? Certainly not in the neighborhood, in these mushrooming, ticky-tacky subdivisions. A rabbi in Pennsylvania declares that while he wouldn't be happy to hear that a prospective convert did not believe in God, he'd have to accept her if she agreed to live a Jewish life and to throw in her lot with the Jewish people. End of quote. Here we surely have a new definition of a Jew. Or is it? Solutions. These are the things today's psychologists are pointing to. And while many agree on the problems, not many propose the same solution. The question of finding our short-term identity, as we have termed it, is complicated by this modern trend toward diffusion of the self. Instead of the old psychology of a single self, often dominated or repressed, with willpower and conscience forming its character. The moderns give us a plurality of different voices, fractional selves, and tell us that these need to be integrated. They may even assert that to think of each of us as a separate, monolithic, unchanging persona is an obstructing fiction. Today's personality, in quotes, is many selves, contending with one another. This inner fragmentation is seen, for example, in one part of our mind wanting something and another part knowing we have no right to it. Such frustration results in the development of neurotic symptoms. When public figures become exposed for abuse of office, caught with the smoking gun, so to speak, from their embarrassed faces, we hear these words, "It was beyond my control, I deeply regret, and so on, as if their present self-state were the only one worth considering. A busy doctor, for instance, might do better to say, my professional self wants to do rounds at the hospital, but my spontaneous self wants to go out to the golf course. Then he can make a conscious choice and realize which self he is electing. It reminds us of Swami Vivekananda's dictum, don't repent. That is, acknowledge a mistake and move on. Personality splitting, they say, is a basic mental mechanism, but we must integrate these sub-selves to make a coherent self. It's useful sometimes to take extreme cases. For example, an alcoholic self's purpose is to get a drink, to celebrate, to cheer up, to forget, and no hiding behind rationalizations. Similarly, with the procrastinator self, the optimist self, the gambler, the pessimist, the go-getter, the dreamer, adventurer, the scaredy-cat, the cynic. Then there is that special class who are always becoming and never quite reach, the painters and writers who don't get inspired, the graduate students whose theses drag on, actresses and musicians who never seem to be quite in the right place at quite the right time. A gender difference. Women in particular throughout human history have not been encouraged to ask, who am I? Defined by their relationships and the role assigned to them by nature, they have been expected to please others. In the old India, this was the rule of thumb. Nothing else was anticipated. The woman becomes somebody, not as a careerist, not even as a wife, but as mother, and doubly so if the baby is male. Again, she has another role if widowed. This is sometimes true even in the liberated West, so-called liberated West. We think of an example in which a very powerful woman, a hospital administrator that we knew, abjectly crumbled on hearing her mother's voice on the phone, presumably putting her in her place. In one of Erickson's writings, he asserts that identity involves both a sense of continuity within oneself and some measure of agreement between that sense and the perception of the self by others. In other words, if people around you don't know who or what you are, something is wrong. They say we can have a number of sub-personalities, but there must be an inner observer and organizer who can declare, I needed this self in the past, but I've outgrown it. We must take full responsibility for ourselves. As Sri Ramakrishna put it, let there be no thievery in the granary of the mind. The sub-selves must not be disconnected islands. The media, which present us with dazzling, diverse role models and lifestyles, give the impression that anyone is free to be anyone if he or she only learns to act the part. The doctor finds the patient expects him to react to his problem with stereotyped phrases, and so he gives them. And the patient's own conviction is only reinforced. Television dramas turn human conflicts into aesthetic happenings. When real life seems not to be exciting enough, dramatic techniques are used to hype it with docudramas and so on. As a result, people begin to experience themselves as part of a show, vividly exemplified in the TV talk shows. We may be able to delineate three steps in this process. First, producers and directors, themselves borderline personalities, put forth their versions of reality. Second, the public readily accepts that this is the way things are, telling it like it is, we say heavily. Third, the values of the characters depicted soon get assimilated into the culture. Three sorts of selves. All this theatricality increases our self-consciousness, the awareness of our lower self. Someone has said that the saddening paradox of modern life is the coexistence of a heightened self-sense coupled to an increasingly fragmented identity. The Wonder of Being Human is the title of a work by Sir John Eccles, a Nobel Prize winner, and David N. Robinson, who have made some nice distinctions we should like to summarize here. The book defines self as an awareness of being I am. One's self-identity is who one is based on memory. An amnesiac, for instance, has the first, the I am, but lacks the second. Then there is the third, which they call our personal identity. That is, others' knowledge of who one is. When we meet a total stranger, we may have the second, but not have the third. The total amnesiac may not have either the second or the third, but he still has the first, the I am. The authors make a study of multiple personality, as in the movie Three Faces of Eve, and come up with a conclusion that such cases are not three selves in one person, but three different self-identities possessed by one otherwise unique and irreducible self. The outlook of Vedanta. We have seen that many modern psychologists agree on the two mistakes we usually make regarding the human will. Either we totally abdicate our will, or we define it with Victorian simplistic rigidity. But these counselors see nothing amiss in trying to persuade ourselves that we are a group of selves, a team. Now, this is where Vedanta markedly differs. Our spiritual intuition tells us a different story. Shankara says that all compound or combination things exist for the purposes of a single agent. In a group of musicians playing chamber music, for example, it may appear or may even be prescribed that they have no conductor. The organizing agent, however, is the composer, whose indications the group has agreed to portray. When the psychologists say, choose consciously among your sub-selves, be ready to express one, equally ready to discard one, Vedanta would have to ask, who is making this choice? What we posit is called an antaryami, the reflected self as an inner controller. I should like to turn now to some pronouncements on identity, which I consider authoritative, surveying the whole field from recent times, teachers I've known, back through the founders of the Ramakrishna movement, and then to the more ancient authorities, the Smriti and Shruti, the scriptures of Vedanta. Spokesman of today. Here is one. Quote, who am I? A being who has had much more experience and has made many more choices than I can now recall. Enough experience and choice, in fact, to have built up my present character, mentality, and body. I am what I have thought. I am the residuum of many choices. Therefore, I blame no one and accept full responsibility. What am I? One of the innumerable beings passing up through time to timelessness. I am here partly to discharge my own mistakes and partly to develop rudimentary constructive beginnings. Why am I? That I may so act toward myself and so act toward and through these others that they and I may come to realize that we are one, and thus attain the complete unity. I am in the presence of ascending invisible powers of being, as much above me as I seem to be above the animals and insects. This ascent continues until the highest beings, free from time, are without separation and become united with the eternal. I therefore draw myself up toward that light by an ascending contemplation of ever higher being until I contemplate that being which, because it transcends all time, space, and separation, must be immanent and therefore possesses even me. That was a passage from Gerald Hurd's little book, The Recollection. Differences which drop away. Do you know that when this higher consciousness grows within you, it is not possible for you, or certainly it is not instinctive with you, to recognize that here is a woman and here is a man? That sense goes away. No doubt many of you are surprised to hear this. What do you mean by that? Don't you see anymore? You must admit that men look different from women, and don't you think that if you have good eyes you will recognize the difference, even if you are an illumined soul? No. One of our great Swamis, Swami Turiyananda, who lived for some years in this country, later said in India, "While I was in America, I was not conscious of the difference between men and women." End of quote. When I first heard about this, it made a very deep impression on my mind. I was then a novice in one of our monasteries, and I thought, what a wonderful thing that is. After all, there is no man, no woman in God. And if everyone is really divine, you cannot say, here is a man and here is a woman. To perceive the difference is a violation of the truth. You may say, well, it may have been a very special thing with Swami Turiyananda. Of course, it is a special thing. It is not an easy thing to perceive. Another quote from the same book, "I have often thought that if from their birth children did not hear such debilitating statements as, you are a born sinner, you are a man, you are a poor man, you are a healthy man, a good man, a bad man, but were told instead, day after day, you are eternal, you are immortal, you are ever pure, you are full of knowledge, full of strength, full of blessedness, this truth would become a power in their life, even when they grew up and their other instincts began to prevail." End of quote.